This is Tess, and I'm going to be reading from Atlas Obscura, the definitive guide to the world's hidden wonders. When pianos went to war, Steinway & Sons' victory verticals were tougher than your average upright by Winnie Lee. Banging out a melody on the ivories doesn't seem like it has anything to do with winning a war, but that doesn't mean that pianos haven't had a place in the American military. New York-based Steinway & Sons even had a model of upright piano known as Victory Verticals, or G.I. Steinways, that were built specifically for troops in World War II. During the war, the U.S. government essentially shut down the production of musical instruments in order to divert vital resources such as iron, copper, brass, and other materials to the war effort. Yet the government also determined that the war effort ought to include entertainment that could lift soldiers' spirits. But just any old piano wouldn't do. They needed ones hardy enough to withstand the trying conditions out in the field, including being packed into a crate and dropped out of a plane. That music was deemed to be such a powerful morale boost that pianos were actually built to be parachuted around the world is incredible, says Jonathan Piper, manager of Artifact and exhibitions at the Museum of Making Music in Carlsbad, California, which has a Victory Vertical in its collection. Steinway & Sons, the president of which had four sons in the military at the time, had shifted its efforts to constructing tails, wings, and other parts for troop transport gliders before the commission for the Rough and Ready Pianos came through. The company was famous for its pianos, but those finely tuned models weren't well suited to where soldiers were stationed, including in the tropics. While preserving a high level of craftsmanship, Steinway designed a piano that was rugged and durable, says Piper, and they had to be economical in their use of materials. That started from the ground up. The Victory Vertical didn't have legs like most upright pianos, Piper says, because that wouldn't have withstood an airdrop. Other special features included water-resistant glue and anti-insect treatments, keys covered with celluloid instead of ivory, and bass strings wound in soft iron instead of the traditional copper. They were designed to contain only a tenth as much material as a normal piano. There were also handles placed under the keyboard in the back so that four soldiers could carry the 455-pound instrument. And beyond all that, the instrument is visually interesting, Piper says. Because of its purpose-built design, the Victory Vertical has an elegant simplicity. Then there's the colors. Unlike the vast majority of pianos that come in a black or dark wood finish, the Victory Vertical was painted in olive green, like the example at the museum, blue and gray. By the end of the war, Steinway had produced about 5,000 Victory Verticals, roughly half of which went to military service. The others were sold to schools and churches. Piper notes that the specially designed instruments were an incredible moment for the makers of musical instruments and their resilience through the war years. But more remarkable were the moments of comfort, joy, and camaraderie those pianos created in difficult times. The company has a 1943 letter from a private, Kenneth Cranes, stationed in North Africa, to his mother back in New York. Quote, "We all got a kick out of it and sure had fun after meals when we gathered around the piano to sing," he wrote, just a week before he was killed in battle. "I slept smiling, and even today am humming a few of the songs we sang." There's also five or six fantastic pictures of the piano, including a group of GIs singing around one out in the field. For our next story, the Witch House of Salem, one of the only structures left with direct ties to the Salem witchcraft trials of 1692. The Salem witchcraft trials took place between February 1692 and May 1693. More than 200 people were accused, 59 were tried, 31 were found guilty, and 20 were executed. Those final unfortunates were hanged, and one man was crushed to death while being tortured. Among the judges who convicted the witches based on spectral evidence, or evidence based upon dreams or visions, was Jonathan Corwin. As a local magistrate and civic leader, Corwin was called upon to investigate the claims of diabolical activity when a surge of witchcraft accusations arose in Salem and neighboring communities. He took the place of Judge Nathaniel Saltonstall, who resigned after the execution of Bridget Bishop. Corwin served on the Court of Oyer and Terminer, which ultimately sent 19 people to the gallows. All 19 refuse to admit to witchcraft and maintain their innocence. The Witch House, as it is now known, was his home and is the only structure still standing in Salem, Massachusetts, with direct ties to the Salem Witch Trials of 1692. The house was bought by Judge Corwin in 1675 when he was 24 years old, and he lived there for more than 40 years. Corwin is buried in nearby Broad Street Cemetery. The house remained in the Corwin family until the mid-19th century. Today, the house is a museum focusing on 17th century living. It's one of the last remaining links to a time in American history when people were hanged because they supposedly inflicted pain by the use of venomous and malignant particles that were ejected from the eye. Know before you go, if you're visiting Salem during Samhain, better known as Halloween or any time in the month of October, get there early, even during the week. One does not simply get a parking space for any length of time. In Boston, Massachusetts, the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, also known as the Gardner. 2,000 artifacts from around the world collected by one woman with an addiction. The low-key three-floor Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum embodies a woman who for over three decades assembled a collection of more than 2,000 artifacts, paintings, sculptures, objects, textiles, drawings, manuscripts, photographs, letters, etc., from around the world. Isabella's story is intriguing, and her collection, a lifetime's pursuit of diverse eccentricities, conveys the energy one woman found in the art of collections. The story begins when Isabella lost her first and only child to pneumonia. Soon after, she discovered she would be unable to conceive again. Traumatized by the loss of her child and the barren news, Isabella felt defeated and sank into a two-year seclusion in which she remained in her room, refusing to interact with the outside world. In the end, it was Isabella's husband's decision to take her on a trip across Europe that revived Isabella's love for life, setting in motion what was to become a lifelong addiction. From her travels all over Europe, the Middle East, and Asia, Isabella found a new purpose, bringing back strange and beautiful objects from these foreign lands. After filling several warehouses in Boston with her new goods, she decided to build Fenway Court to house her entire collection, which she opened to the public in 1903. However, not much is known about Isabella's private life. She burned thousands of her letters before she died, leaving very little information about her personal story. Certainly, however, an intriguing persona lay behind this collection. In 1888, it took painter John Sargent 9 tries to get the portrait that Isabella wanted of herself right. She was an energetic, intellectual curiosity, but much of what the world knew about her came from her public-facing role as a socialite and avid collector of foreign esoteric things. Her collection included framed textiles, signed letters from celebrities, and strange artifacts such as a 17th-century silver German ostrich. When seen as a whole, the eclectic mix portrays the interest and curiosities of a woman from the late 19th century with the means to follow through on her passions. Isabella Gardner is a perfect example of the difficulty in distinguishing an eccentric collector from a compulsive hoarder. Where does one draw the line? Is it a matter of taste or refinement? Quality over quantity? The ability to purchase more space so as to not wallow in what's been amassed? Granted, most people don't spend millions of dollars amassing treasures like an Isabella, or trek the planet in search of curiosities, but we all have our quirks that hold inexplicable power to us alone. In 1990, the museum security guards admitted two men posing as Boston police officers who went on to steal $500 million worth of art and collectibles. With no leads decades later, the event is the largest unsolved theft in art history. Some of the paintings were simply cut out of their frames. Those empty frames still hang on the wall, awaiting the return of their contents. The museum continues to offer a reward of $10 million for information leading to the recovery of stolen items. Know before you go. Take the Huntington Avenue No. 39 bus or the Green Line E-train to the museum stop. Cross Huntington to Lewis Prang Street. Walk down Lewis Prang for 2 blocks. The museum is on the left. You can see the MFA from the Gardner. They are very close together. Canned bread, a New England tradition of steaming bread in coffee tins, gave rise to this niche snack. Boston brown bread may date back to colonial America, but eating it now hardly feels like dining with the pilgrims. This steamed, molasses-laden comfort food comes in a can. You'll need an opener to crack the lid off and thwack or jiggle out the dense roll of bread inside. For some New Englanders, especially in the Boston area in Portland, Maine, it's a nostalgic childhood tradition. The recipe calls for cornmeal mixed with molasses and rye and wheat flours. Traditionally, the mixture is then poured into a coffee can or small mold and steamed until it rises. The result? A bread as sweet and dense as cake. The legacy of the 17th century recipe has been carried on by companies like B&M, which also sells Boston baked beans. Locals don't bat an eye when they have to search for canned bread among stewed peaches and kidney beans in the supermarket. New Englanders serve canned bread several ways. Once extracted from its can, the bread can be sliced and served simply with butter, cream cheese, or jam. B&M offers a plain version or one with raisins. For a heartier meal, a Saturday night tradition involves pouring baked beans and chopped hot dogs over the bread. It's a niche tradition, even within New England, but given the shelf life, it's not surprising that canned bread has lasted this long. Need to know. Taking the top and bottom off the can makes it easier to get the bread out of the can. If you don't live near a grocery store with canned bread, you can find recipes online. In Boston, Massachusetts, the Maparium, that's spelled M-A-P-P-A-R-I-U-M, an enormous inside-out glass globe built in 1935. In the early 1930s, Boston architect Chester Lindsay Churchill was commissioned to design the new Christian Science Publishing Society's headquarters to compete with the other grand newspaper headquarters of the day. The New York Daily News building had its famous gigantic spinning globe. Naturally, the Christian Science Monitor had to do one better. Enter the Maparium, a three-story tall, inside-out, stained-glass globe that is bisected in the middle by a glass walkway. Once illuminated with hundreds of lamps, today it glows with the lights of LED. The Maparium gives you a rare chance to see the world in a way that doesn't distort the surface of the Earth. Even when looking at an accurate globe, the relative sizes of the continents are distorted by perspective, as the spherical shape causes different regions to appear at different distances from the eye. But with a view from the very center of a globe looking outward, the eye is in the same distance from every point on the map. It's fascinating to view the Earth this way for the first time. Africa is huge. North America, Europe, and Asia are all jammed up against the North Pole. You have to look nearly straight up to see them. Sizes and locations of continents and countries you've always taken for granted are suddenly unfamiliar. While the relative size and position of the continents are correct, the map's political boundaries are long out of date. The Maparium hasn't changed since 1935. It's still possible to find Siam and French Indochina, but not Israel or Indonesia. The USSR looms large. Africa remains a large block of European colonies. The most curious part of all about the Maparium is its acoustics. When you stand at the center of the perfect sphere, you can hear your voice in full 360-degree surround sound. The curved glass walls do not absorb the sound waves, but reflect them back. That's also why those at one end of the bridge can hear the whisper of those at the other end, loud and clear. This effect is called the whispering galley. Before you go, the Maparium is located in the Mary Baker Eddy Library, a Blue Star Museum. It's open daily from 10 to 5 p.m. General admission is $6. Photography is not permitted inside the Maparium. And we're going to end with a story about holofruit. It looks like an exploding planet and tastes like sugarcane. And it's spelled H-A-L-A. And I have seen them in the grocery store. Seeing a holofruit for the first time may leave you wondering if you're looking at a giant pine cone or a mutant pineapple. Holofruit, which is eaten exclusively by Pacific Islanders and visitors to the region, is made up of dozens of segments called keys or cones. The innards of each key are pulpy, while the green outer edge is so fibrous it can be used as dental floss. Islanders chew on the raw fruit, boil it with grated coconut, or grind it into a paste. One taster likened the flavor of fresh challah juice to a mixture of sugarcane and mango with the consistency of thick nectar. Another useful application of of Holofruit Keys, Lay's. Just don't make one using the fresh fruit unless you plan to eat it soon after. The fruit ferments rapidly, emitting a stench that's earned it the name stink nut. Need to know. To eat a fresh Holofruit, use the claw of a hammer to remove a couple of the keys. The rest should pop out easily. Chew on the center of each key to break down the fibers, then suck out the sweet nectar inside.